All right, you guys, at this time I want to introduce the speaker. This dude, man, I met him in service work, he does a lot of H&I work here in our district. And, man, instantly the guy just, man, I really like what he had to share, and I really like the way he shared it. His name's Randy. Randy.
My name's Randy, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here and sober, and sincerely hope that the things that are said and read here tonight will keep us sober until we lay our heads down. That's not something original. I don't really have any original things. I get it all from you folks. But that has always struck me when it was shared, because it's true. If I focus one moment at a time, today I have a good chance that I'm not going to take a drink. And it's because of this program and the grace of God. Rhonda, congratulations on a year. Charles, congratulations on 4 years. And Gus, congratulations on 18 years. My sobriety birthday is July 24th of 2015. Like some of you, I'm glad we don't shoot our wounded in this program, because I came in here probably about 25, 26 years ago. And Charles, I did get sober in Washington. If you're talking Washington State, and had some sobriety and stuff, but I have a lot more issues besides alcoholism, and it's important that I address those. I have some things that were selfish in my life that I reserve the right to continue to do when sober, and since I'm really good at rationalizing, a lot of those things I did, I saw you folks in the rooms of AA doing it, and I thought, it's okay for me to do. Other people do it. But my higher power, there was this gnawing sense, and some men in the rooms who cared about me were like, that's not a good idea, Randy. And for one of those things is gambling. And I've been a gambler since I grew up in a gambling family, and that's just part of my story. I think by the age of 4 or 5, I was looking for a surface, we used to call it, to pitch pennies, nickels, and dimes and quarter against the wall. You know, in the neighborhood, I grew up in I was born in San Jose, and I'd come around a corner in an apartment complex, and there'd be some older kids pitching. Sometimes adults shooting craps on the side, and I love that. And I love that kind of action. So, that being said, before I get too carried away, I didn't have anything really to, I just asked God that when I'm asked to share that, I'll share what I've been told, how it was, what changed, and what it's like now. And the spiritual experience in the back, Appendix 2, in the back of the book, is something that means a lot to me. And I think in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're at a big book study, if it's a big book meeting, a lot of times when it comes to the appendix, you know, go back, if you go to the bottom, it says go to Appendix 2 in the back and read about it. We don't do that. And so I just feel led to read that to start tonight. Spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. And I was taught by my first sponsor in the big book, when this sentence is in italics, when the writing changes in the big book, he's looked at me and he said, that means pay attention, Randy. You pay attention. And that's what he do. Pay attention. Okay. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer wrote that. Contempt prior to investigation. That's the way I rolled. I judge everybody. To this day, I start my mornings on my knees because I was taught, you know, you do that. Why do I have to get on my knees? Why can't I just pray? My sponsor said at the time, because it's tangible evidence, Randy, for yourself that there's something bigger than you. That's why you get your big ass on your knees, because you got a huge ego and you need to humble yourself. Now, that's for me. I don't tell somebody how to pray. I just, when I'm working with people, I go, this is what I do. I know the old timers, guys would grab a guy's hand and pull you down on your knees and stuff. I've heard stories. I'm the type of alcoholic. I'm a recovered jock too. So I have I was a decent athlete. It's the only thing looking back on it, that God, that kind of kept my alcoholism and my drug addiction kind of not as out of control, because I could sweat it all out of me. In my younger years, it kept me from going overboard. I grew up in a family of alcoholics. My grandmother and my grandfather, who I spent a lot of time with, because my father left my brother and I. I have a younger brother who's a year and a half younger than me. And probably about two or three, dad decided that he wanted to mess around with other women. And left my mom. And I had a lot of anger. I can't, maybe there was a time that I was happy. I, you know, didn't have that inner turmoil, but I don't know. There was a lot of violence. My mom, God bless her, I had a lot of anger towards her. I took it out on her. My brother was very quiet. I led him through the neighborhoods. I cried a lot, and I smashed things and punched things and took it out on my poor mom. And because I thought she was to blame, my father was this guy that came in and out on weekends, you know, and sometimes he wouldn't show up, and that was gut-wrenching. So I took it out on my mother and my grandparents, because I blamed them, because they were saying, you can't go with your father. And I was just caught up in between. But as I've done the work, and my mom was an alcoholic, started drinking a lot. And as I've done the work and looked at my poor, precious mom, she died of alcoholism. It's amazing she lasted to 58. She was a beautiful woman. She was homecoming queen of San Jose City College. She was a ground setter. I think she instilled in me, I know she instilled in me my love of diverse people and culture, because she was told by my grandfather once it was announced that she was the homecoming queen. My grandfather said, "Well, Judith, that's wonderful, but do not kiss any of those black men on the basketball team." And it was looking back on the photos, because she kept them all. I went through them. They were all black. This is probably 1960, 1961. And so even my dad said this, because my dad wasn't dating her, but he saw it. He was there. And she went up to everyone and congratulated them after their big game, and they honored her, and she kissed every single one of those men on the cheek. And she's my hero. Now, I didn't know that when I was young, but she also came home that night, and her grandfather kicked her out. She was at 19 and kicked her out and said, "Judith, you're not welcome in our home anymore." So they loved her, but they were drunks, and she loved them, but she became a drunk. And I said I would never drink. Raise your hand if anybody had parents and you said, "I'm never going to." You know, I remember I just said, I never did. Now, I was great. Those of us that grew up in alcoholic homes, you might know when was the right time to hit up the family for cash. You know, I knew exactly how many beers for my grandmother, how many for my mom. You know, my grandfather I didn't mess with. I waited till he passed out. Then I'd go through his drawers. You know, I just had it all. At a young age, I had this all worked out, how to steal and get what was mine. And I stole from stores at a young age, got busted. But that's what I did. I was a thief. I was a thief from the get-go. I started smoking pot when I was – somebody offered me a joint when I was 11. I was at their house. It's probably 1977. And I smoked that joint, and I loved it. It was just old Mexican shake, Colombian or something. But I smoked it, and I watched Test Patterns, because the TVs in the old days, for that you young people, I'm 58. Those of us that are older can remember, television used to go off. I mean, it was off. And then the American flag would start waving, and some music comes, and then we'd just go, thump. I used to wonder, wow. And I'm high, and I'm with Barry Duncan, because he had the pot, and his dad was a pot smoker, and he was in bed, and I'm watching those tests. That screen go away, and I just looked at it for an hour or two, thinking, laughing, thinking, that's amazing. Where does it go? When are they going to come? And they don't come back. You know, I was just thought it was a funny. So I didn't drink. I managed not to drink, and I got by with pot. You know, when I started to have some success in sports, you know, there was drinking, and I was irritable, restless, and discontented, And it didn't happen until I was older. I went to being a, you know, growing up as I did, maybe some of you, I went to probably 8 different schools in 12 years of education, just because, and they weren't that far away from each other. I did move in with my dad because I was so angry with my mom, blaming her, and a wonderful stepfather who at the time, though, I didn't treat him very nice. But he was, I'll get to that later. He was a good man. And so I moved in with my father, and he had a well-to-do girlfriend, and they were living. I went from tough skin pants with tons of patches on them where I could barely bend my knees and a white T-shirt to a full wardrobe. And I was in sixth grade, and I moved to Palo Alto, California, where Stanford was. And then, you know, I eventually things didn't work out with my dad and I. And I said, I'll show you a nice woman who I've reconnected with, Georgianne. She was the woman. She tried her best. She was married to my dad. And my dad's not a bad man. He's just got his own character defects. And he's done the best he could. But I came home from cutting school, and I was doing a lot of things they didn't know. And she goes, "You know what? You can go back and live with your mother." And she didn't. She had said that a few times, and she said it one too much, because I'm so fine. I will. And I moved back in with my mom middle of my sophomore year, and that was pretty humbling. I wore the same outfit for a week and a half, the same clothes, and a lot of people do that, but I had all of a sudden been exposed to, you know, all this stuff. So looking back on it, I had this inclination that it wasn't about stuff, but I didn't drink, smoked pot when I could, and I got an opportunity to have some success playing basketball. I did other sports, but basketball was what I had some success in. And I remember I got along with everybody pretty much, you know. I didn't really join anything. And I remember walking down the hall, and I guess I'd had a big game. And I'm walking through the hall, and the halls of the high school, and all of a sudden I felt like everybody was looking at me, you know. And I'm pretty self-absorbed anyway. But this was like, they were like looking at me and like going, you know, like, and the girls were like, and I'm like, this is, and again, those of you that are alcoholics have done the work. I wasn't comfortable with that. I didn't know what it was about. Well, it was about because I had had some success playing basketball. And really all I ever wanted to do, and it still was my big goal, even though I went on to play college and had an opportunity to play overseas, but my alcoholism and my cocaine abuse had other ideas. And it wasn't. I digress. So I went up to Washington to, I grew up working in restaurants, washed dishes, 13, 14, busboy, was waiting tables by the time I was 20, dropped out of junior college because school was not for me. I went there and I barely graduated by one credit because I wanted to be eligible for the sports. So I'm grateful I had sports because I graduated by one credit. And when everybody else was taking three or four classes and leaving at lunch, I was taking seven periods. And I remember waiting in line for the diplomas and everybody's in the line. And I'm like, they're like, what's the deal? We got our cap and gown, what's the deal? And everybody's waiting for me. And I'm like, I don't have my diploma. And they're like, well, where is it? I'm like, I'm waiting for Wilcox to give it to me. And I guess he thought so highly of me, he waited till 30 minutes before graduation to finally come out and go, here, Mr. Reeves. And all my friends go, we can go now. Story of mine, you know. But I graduated. But then wasn't mature enough in a junior college where you're going to school with a lot of different kind of characters. That's when I started doing cocaine. I missed a game because I was doing cocaine. I was in Tahoe and I lost track of time. And I called my mom, I think, to ask her to send me some money. And she'd go, you have a game against San Francisco City College tonight. Where are you? I'm not going to make it. So I decided college isn't for me. I went to work. And started partying really well until a coach got a hold of me in Redwood City at Kenyatta College. And even though I tried to get out of it, I was scared academically, full of fear, the same things. And because I'm undisciplined, didn't want to do the work, didn't realize that it's hard to fail in anything. If you show up every single day on a consistent basis, it's hard to fail. And but he had faith in me, and I was able to have some success and had some scholarship offers. And I ended up going up to a little school in Washington State called St. Martin's. And I left. I wanted to get out of California because I was starting to use cocaine a lot. I remember having the biggest game. It was for the Coast Conference Championship, packed, thousands of people in the gym. Big game. We have this amazing team. And I had overshot the mark the night before and did cocaine till about 5 a.m. We had a game at 7 o'clock that night. And that's for those of you that remember Lenny Bias from the Boston Celtics had blown his heart out the day before he signed a multi-million-dollar contract. Jeep Jackson out of El Paso. Countless guys. I'd seen some of the 49ers doing cocaine, so I'm like, you know, I worked at a restaurant they came into, so I thought, oh, they're doing it, you know. But really, I was just a drunk and an addict. But I'm sitting on the free throw line. I had at the end of the game, and I'm getting ready to shoot two free throws, and the crowd and the noise, and all I, as I'm getting ready to shoot, in my thought, and I've shared this before, my thought was, I wonder what would happen if I had a heart attack right now and just dropped dead. Because my heart was beating so fast and I was detoxing so hard. And instead of focusing on this amazing, one of the great moments for everybody, I'm consumed with self. And that's what my disease did. And I went up, but I ended up in Washington after going to Europe and living in LA, going back to San Francisco for a while. I ended up back in Olympia. A woman came up to me at a party. I was dating somebody else. And I have never, until my current wife, I have never not put the cart before the horse when it comes to relationships. And that's an old term for those of you that remember. Meaning, you like me, let's have sex. And no friendship. I have no idea how to have proper friendships with women. And so I'm at this party, and this, I'm probably 29, and this woman comes up to me, and I'm with another woman, says, I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm going to marry you, and I'm going to bear your children. And I'm like, well, okay, whatever. Well, she was right. I had two beautiful daughters, Mackenzie and Madeline, with her. I have two grandchildren. Zoe, who will be four in December, and little Boston, who is going to be a year. And I just spent last week, the gift of this program, in Oregon with my second wife, being with the grandkids and my two daughters and their husband and her boyfriend. My wife and I got married, and she said to me, you know, the one thing, she was around a lot of alcoholism. Her dad was an alcoholic, and she said to me, one night after we were drinking, I think it was before we got married, you know, the only thing that's going to ruin our marriage is your drinking. And, you know, she was right. And the first time I got exposed to AA officially is I was going to some meetings here and there because I was feeling the pressure. I also did a master's program, which I never finished. But the class, I'm taking this class called Trauma and the Therapist, and I'm reading, and it says, if the therapist doesn't identify his own character defects, the client will. And for whatever reason, that hit me like, how am I going to be a therapist? This alcohol keeps, you know, I'm like 33, 34. And I knew I was an alcoholic, but that's just the price of doing business. You know, I'm not ready. What solution do I have? You know, I can put a couple days together. And so I started going to some meetings with encouragement from her, and then really got into it when she said, I don't want you to live with us anymore. And my kids were like 4 and 3. And I'm like, God, I'm doing just what the same stuff my family, you know, that I grew up with. So I got a good sponsor because I'd been around for a couple years, and I got a guy. He was a Dodger fan. God bless him. I sat next to him at 160 group, men's group, when I first met him, and I had my Giants hat on, and I sit at this table, and this little pint-sized dude looks over at me and goes, you think you could have picked a better hat? And that was Dave, the Hammer, they called him. And he celebrated 38 years of sobriety. He's from Hawthorne originally, but has been in Olympia for 30 years. He's my dear friend. And we walked through, I got some time. Got like six and a half years. Life got better. I started coaching, which I was always fearing that I didn't really know a lot about the game. I was more of a street ball player. I just played by feel. But I said yes to a reasonable request. And I, it was one of the great, and I got some great mentors outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was wonderful. My wife still drank, and I didn't think that was a problem. And looking back on it, you know, I know that some people in the rooms are married to people that drink, and that can work for them. But looking back on it, she was also smoking pot, and I didn't like it when I, you know, we'd had the ups and downs. One time I knew she was smoking pot driving our kids. And that was before it's, you know, now it's maybe looked, it's not frowned upon as much because it's legal. But I don't know. To me, any substance at all that I put in my body that changes the way I feel, you know, I can't do it. And but I didn't have the tools back then. And I was still gambling. I was still, when I was pissed off or whatever, I'm going to have my time, my time. So my part in it, looking back on my part of my relationship, is I abandoned my first wife. A lot of times when she needed me, would it have worked? I don't know. But we're taught in this program, when we go through the steps, which I did when I came back in over 8 years ago, and I did a thorough, for the first time, mind you, I've been around for a while, I did a thorough sex inventory. And sex, it's not just about sex, right? It's about all intimate relations. It's a lot deeper. The sex inventory was, I had this idea about it. It's not just about who you had sex with or who you made out with or who you did whatever with. It's about our intimate relationships, because I struggle with intimate relationships. And I have to understand why I struggle, why I'm uncomfortable, because I don't like myself. I don't wake up in the morning and go, God, you're such a great... I never woke up. I could have the biggest game or have this girl or have a lot of money. I have more peace today because I've looked at things deeper. And I'm glad the only thing I did was I lived. Because when I went back out, I'm on the streets, you know. I know how to go to the fancy places and look nice and do all that, but I'm a dive bar drinker, meet the guys on the streets, then hit the casino. I love Vegas. I drool when I say Vegas. Still to this day, I went to Vegas all the time. You know, I'm a poker player. All you people that play, another ego, that play video games and slot machines and blackjack and pie gal, all that, you're losers. You know, me, I'm playing against other people, not against the house. That was my thinking. That's me. So when I came back in, that sponsor of mine, who I made fun of, Dave, who I used to go, you know, Dave, because the way he lived, and, you know, that's a little over the top. You know, you're a little bit, you know, and I thought that. And I got to tell him that this last time. And when I came back in, I told him, because for me, it all started with the pencil, the dishonesty, the gambling, all those things lead to something happens where the shame and guilt of what I've done, the same feeling that I've had since I can remember, that feeling comes, and the only thing I can do is take that drink. That obsession is there. And I'm like, I'm getting a 40 of Mickey's and it's on. Why I took the drink? What? I'm an alcoholic. That's normal for me. But looking at the reasons I did was deep. And I had to come to him and told him I got fired from a job. I took stuff from work that didn't belong to me. I was abusing pain meds. I had taken pain meds with prescriptions many times being an athlete. Never. One day, in sobriety, it dawned on me I had some pain meds. I'm like, I wonder if I'm going to take two instead of one. You know, I never thought to take two ibuprofen. You know, I mean, if I had 600 milligrams, now two of the smaller ones, but you know what I'm saying? I'm like, I'm going to take two pain pills instead of one. It was incredible. I knew, all of a sudden, I know what people that were talking about heroin and opioids and everything, and I'm going to meetings, yeah, I'm sober, and I'm taking two instead. Well, I'm just taking two. Next thing you know, I'm lying to the doctor. And it could have got a lot worse, but I got caught at work. I didn't die. Drank for 3 days. Knew where this was going. It was tough because I still had money. I don't know, but I had, you know, I burned things to the ground. You know, I still had resources. I'm like, my healthy thinking, I'm like, and this went on for a year. You know, that's why I got into H&I and I was going to juvenile where I'd been. And I've got how many, I've got 15 days. You know, I'm talking to 15 to 21-year-olds, and I've got 15 days. They're like, come with us. It saved my life. I had 51% more to stay sober than the 49% when on the way there, like, forget it, man. I can live for a year, burn this to the ground, and just go out in a blaze of glory, leaving Las Vegas style. And H and I saved my life. And I immediately got to the steps. I put gambling on the table and looked at it throughout my life, for the wrote all about it. I did a thorough sexual inventory. And when my sponsor talked about intimate relationships, and I broke it down into categories like I'd done before, but I just said, here, take it. Because I didn't want to give up playing poker. I've been doing it forever. But, you know, thinking about it, it didn't bring a lot of joy to me. It really didn't. Glenn and I were talking. It didn't bring that peace. Whether I won, lost, it wasn't right for me anymore. And it's not innately bad for you or anybody else, but for me, for my relationship with my higher power, it was killing me. And going through that, and also help with a therapist, a lot of us in Alcoholics Anonymous have been sexually abused. If I hadn't done that thorough sexual inventory, I wouldn't got the freedom to realize that the things that took place to me as a little kid weren't dreams that I had pushed aside. Because when I'm a grown man and I'm 50 years old, 51 years old, and these memories are flooding back, and it's like a right to the jaw, and I'm like, in all different scenarios, I'm like, what is this? And I have people I trust that I can talk to. And then I have a therapist. Because in the big book it says, and I encourage it, the steps don't fix everything. So if you're sick in Alcoholics Anonymous, and anybody says the steps will fix everything, I say that is incorrect. Because I can't, when we're young, the trauma, even when we're older, trauma, PTSD, what people go through, that stuff, God made us so we can keep marching on like we're good. Because we're not supposed to feel that kind of pain. Especially as little people. People that, you know, that we think are supposed to trust. For me, it was women. In a way, I thought that was okay because they were women. It's not okay. But now that buzzard on the bedpost in the morning, here I am, another day, Randy. Now I know where that innate, some of those things come from, because I'm free. And I can help other people, other men, when I'm sponsoring them, and share that and let you know that it's okay. It's not okay what happened, and those people were sick, and I forgive them, because I have to forgive them. I have to forgive everybody. I don't have to like people, but my sobriety is dependent on my spiritual condition. And the spiritual solution in this book, that's why I go to a weekly big book study, because I'm not in the book all the time. And I need to be reminded what's in the big book and how this book has saved my life. And that woman that I'm now married to has 24 years of sobriety. And she, when I came back in and I can barely, it's freezing, I have a broken jaw. My face is scarred. I'm freezing. I'm just trying to get to a meeting in the morning. I walked with that woman for 3 months. We had played. I knew her from the program, and she was safe, you know. But I was taught in the program, you know, you treat the sisters with safety. You learn how to do the side hug. You honor them. You watch out for them. Like I do my daughters, like I wish I would have known how to do with my mom and my family. And so she was safe. And then she said, do you want to walk after the meeting? You look like you could walk. It would be good for you, because I wasn't in good shape. So we walked, and I got to know her. I got to know a woman as a friend for 4 or 5 months. And despite all that, I've been with her 14 years. 3 times, with everything I'm telling you, I lied to her. But what she did, and I'm so grateful for her, is she, this program, and a God of her understanding, her personal relationship, she was the first woman that just said to me, Randy, I love you, but I can't live like that. You need to get well. You need to do what you need to do, and I'll be here. If she would have said, like other women, you, I would have had my out. See ya. It's easy. Cut. I don't have to feel anything. You're the problem. You don't care about me. That little boy whose mother like would scream at and yell at and belittle because she was sick in front of the friggin' whole neighborhood. That's what I... But no. Quietly between us. But three times she did that. Three times. But I got it. 8 years ago, I didn't see her for 6 months. She sent me a letter because she said, you need to get well. 6 months into it, I was by myself doing what I told you, doing the H&I, you know, going to meetings, doing the steps, just one, okay. And I did. Part of me was, I did have another motive because she was my friend. I loved her. She was a really good woman. And I really wanted the opportunity to see what life would be like. I didn't know what it would be like, but I wanted to give her a shot. And she sent me a card. And it said, I got it in the mail, and it said, well, hope you're doing well. I always think about you, love you. If you want to call me, call me. It took me 5 minutes or a minute. I was just like a little, hi, how are you? You know, and then I flew in because she had moved to Lompoc. We live in Lompoc, and she had moved because she wanted out of Washington. We had found Lompoc together. She went on with her plan, and I was following her. She lived there 3 years. And then over seven years ago, because of this program and the steps, I moved here. And I made my amends. And I have a relationship with a woman that I didn't do anything but do what I've been taught in these rooms. And I have we pray together. We talk. We disagree. We agree to disagree. We have code words. This is important to me. We rarely break that out. But if she says this is important to me, that means I'm doing it. You know, because it's not like I'm going to have to go, you know, run naked through the streets. But I know it's important because, you know, missing the Niner game or going, you know, to the beach, you know, every part of me wants to see the Niner game. I don't feel like going to the beach. We can go to the beach, but it's important to her. And I've learned to honor her, and she does the same for me. And it's supernatural to be here in this community. Santa Maria, the men's stag, I don't get there often, but H&I, as soon as I moved here, I got into H&I. I immediately got into hospitals and institutions. And carrying the message. And by COVID hit, it used to be so organized in District 52. When I showed up, there was people representing their panels. And there was 16 people in the Freedom Group in Lompoc. And I'm like, boom, I'm in. I signed up. And I'm in the middle of it. COVID hit. It went gone. And there's, unfortunately, where sick people trying to get well, even within the rooms, all of a sudden people are giving positions to people because they don't want to do it. And these people are not, they take it, but they're not ready to do it, you know? And it's just we lost our way. So that being said, my sponsor and I, guess who became the treasurer for District 52? I do not like doing those type of things. I'm an extrovert. I like to be out there. I like to talk to people. I like to carry the message. But being behind the scenes, handling literature, replying to emails, organization, it's not my strong point, but I've done the best I could, and I've stayed sober. I've been doing it like 4 years. There's been two of us for 2 years. Now H&I is picking up steam. We're on Zoom the third Thursday at 7 o'clock. If you're interested, I'll give you the Zoom password and code, you know, all that. Some of you are probably, oh yeah, I do it all the time. I still got to look at my phone. Because it's not in my comfort zone. I'm not a computer person. I don't like to look at a computer. But I'm grateful because it's kept me sober, and I've got to see H&I working, as Marcus knows, all the detoxes in Santa Maria, in Lompoc, the jails, the women's jail here. We need women in the jail here. There's a background check, there's things, but we need women carrying the message in there. Going into the men's jail, I go to the men's colony in San Luis Obispo. And I was sharing with Marcus, I'll end with this, that I've been going into men's colony except for COVID for 6 years. And a lot of the guys in there are lifers, you know, and it's, I've been, done it before, but the power of that meeting in that facility, because these guys come from all different blocks and they have to get okay. They have to go through a lot of hoops to get into that meeting, you know, and sure, are there half steppers or drunks and drug addicts, but the message that they care. When you are up there and I hear a man say, I took this man's life. And I took this man's life and I just didn't take his life. I took his from his family. I took him from his friends. I took him from his kids. I took him from all these things that we know when we do the steps deeply. Because it's not just one person. I'm not really hurting anybody. I'm hurting you. I'm hurting. If I kept doing what I'm doing, I'm not going to have the opportunity to be right here. I didn't plan on this, but I'm grateful. And maybe somebody will get something out of this. That's what it's about. It's for fun and for free. When I hear that, and then you hear a man, guys are like, well, why do you do this? You're never getting out. And a stone cold killer who's been, by the grace of God, healed and has done the work, says, I do it for redemption. Because I have peace now. And maybe some young guy or some guy that's going to get out has hope. That's why I carry the message of H&I. And at 9 a.m., at the roundup, 9 a.m., we're having a Q&A. And we're going to have two people that bring the message into facilities. And two are coming out, and one of the person coming out from the men's colony, I was just in there 2 months ago, and we were talking, and he said, I don't know, I might be getting out. 30 years he was in. I might be getting out. I know his story. He goes, I don't know, but I'll try to reach you, and through the AA way that we can reach each other, John is out. And I talked to him on the phone on Friday, and I'm picking him up at 5 a.m. in Oxnard, and I'm going to bring him. So he can share his experience, strength, and hope with us. Because everybody has value. I don't get to pick and choose. I have to remember that. Whether I can disagree with you, but who am I? Who am I? A thief, a drug addict, a drunk, a liar, a cheat. Like Glenn and I talk about. His story reminds. We all have work. And I hope that you're there at 9 a.m. to hear it from 9 to 10. And we'll have H&I pamphlets there if you're interested. And all the energy. Because the Orcutt Santa Maria, when I'm here at meetings, when I see the message carried into detox and living sober houses, and how sick we get, and then how we're bringing it in with these two folks who here. My wife and I go into detox together. And like Raquel, and Marcus, we were talking about it. On our, we go, okay, we're going. On the way home, we're like, yeah! Better than any game I ever had. Better than any big poker hand I won. Because it's not about me, and I know I'm not capable of it. It's the grace of God. God bless you guys. Thank you. Another game.